right. Men and women, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, whoever else. I probably missed some politically correct categories. Anyway, I'm glad that you are here with me. Greg Kokol is your host, and the show is Stand to Reason, of course. Standing to Reason for classical Christianity and for classical Christian values. Just got back. I get my day so mixed up now. I guess I got back on Sunday. And from Seattle, had a wonderful time there. Had a wonderful time. I think it was Crossroads Bible Church. Was that the church? I don't remember the name of the church so well as the wonderful people that we got to work with. And the first annual Reality Seattle, and that was 2020, and we're looking forward to another one in 2021. And you know what was great about that reality, among a whole host of things, the great speakers, the great presentations, the great interaction with the people, the great impact that we had on the 350 people that showed up and the 50 people that were watching online, was that we were able to have a reality in the midst of a strong lockdown. Some latitude was given to us. So instead of having 1,500 or 2,000 like we might have had, and we have had in the past, we had our 350 because the limit was 400. And so we almost met our limit. But it was so great meeting together all in one spot. Oh, people had masks on and we were socially distanced and all the right things. We were going along with the requirements, but there we were all together, face to face, worship team pounding out worship. It was like church, finally. And so many of us have been locked out of the body of Christ. The church is the ecclesia, the called out ones. We are called out in different ways, called out of the world and into our community. But we are also called out of our of the general population into close personal community when we have church. So the church has church. The church in the first sense has church in the second sense, and for most of us, at least on the West Coast, we have not been able to have church in the second sense in any meaningful way for a long time. So being in Seattle was kind of a breakthrough for us, and we are looking forward now to November 13th and 14th in Minneapolis, where last year we had close to 25,000 people, and this year we have, this year we're able to have 1,500 people, and we've got over 1,000 people signed up already. And so we are really, really thrilled about the potential for November 13th and 14th in Minneapolis. Had just a fabulous time with our great people, and we're really looking forward to it. So if you need to sign up for that and you haven't yet, remember there's limited seating and we're 2/3 full a month out. Go to realityapologetics.com if you want to sign up. Okay, so that's my encouragement and my recommendation. Let's see, what else? Something I have not done for a while, and so I'm going to do it at the top of the show so I don't forget. And that is, I have some events coming up that people can actually go to. For example, this next weekend in Tucson, Arizona, October 23rd through the 25th, that's Friday through Sunday, I'll be part of the Calvary Chapel East Campus Tucson, Arizona event called 2020 Conference, the Insight 2020 Conference. And Frank Turek's going to be there. Let's say J. Warner Wallace will be there. John Lennox will be there by video. Doug Axe will be there. I'm just trying to think of there's just a lot of solid. Mike Lacona, I think, is part of that lineup. I don't actually know right now when I'm speaking. I'll be doing tactics. It's either Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon. We'll have a group conversation on Sunday night, and that'll end the conference. And Monday, we're coming back. My wife is going to be able to go with me for that for 4 days, so I'll be heading out on Thursday. But if you want information on that, go to apologetics.com. AZ, that would be like Arizona, apologeticsaz.org, And that should be the location to get the information you need by for Insight 2020 conference. I'm also doing something in Fairbanks, Alaska, but I'm not actually going to be there. So this I've already filmed the sessions, Decision Making and the Will of God, two of those sessions, really important sessions. So if I don't have to be there, maybe you guys don't have to be there. I'm not exactly sure what the circumstance is going to be. I'm not flying up there, but they may be having kind of an in situ, like sit down conference with some live speakers and some like myself that are going to be piped in on the big screen. And so the church is Bethel Church in Fairbanks, and if you go to BethelChurchAK.org, you can get information on the Christian Thought Forum. I've done that in the past. It's November 6th and 7th, Friday and Saturday, so it's coming up in a couple of weeks, and maybe 3 weeks. And there are other speakers that are involved with that, but I just know my role, and I've already played it, actually. Last week I filmed two events. I did it at my own church and stood on the stage from the podium and addressed the audience left and right as if there was an audience. And since the cameras were tied on me, they couldn't see that nobody was listening except for the two camera people. The way I look at it is this. If you do an event like that and you do a talk like that, as opposed to me standing or rather sitting at my desk in front of the Zoom with all my dirty office all around me talking to a group of people, if I do it with me on the stage, it kind of looks like a regular conference where you're in a big venue and you can't see the little guy on the stage anyway, and you're looking at the big screen. So it's going to be exactly the same kind of presentation. So that's Bethel Church AK. For Alaska, .org, FBethelChurchAK.org, November 6th and 7th. Now, last week I talked a little bit about the process and some of the ideas behind the discussion about Amy Coney Barrett for SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States. And I gave you some concepts about the importance of being conservative, not politically in this case, because judges are not supposed to be political, but rather conservative in their view of the Constitution. That is, the writers of the Constitution had a particular thing in mind. They included certain provisions in the Constitution and subsequent amendments, and we should be ruled by it. And therefore, if we want to be protected by the Constitution, then we have to figure out what the Constitution itself means and not impose an external meaning out of it because we're in new times now and we think this is better, or at least the judges on the bench think it's better. That is not the duty of the judges. That is the duty of the legislature. That is the duty of the Congress, Senate, House, with the executive branch either signing or not signing, therefore vetoing a piece of legislation. All the judges are supposed to do is make sure the law is followed as written. And when it comes to Constitution or the Supreme Court, then the law there is the Constitution. That's the main focus. That is when you have federal issues. Now, I made also a comparison of that concept, the activist judge concept of treating the Constitution as a so-called living document, which means they could read new meaning into it that was not part of the original intent. I paralleled that. I compared it to the way many people read their Bibles as a so-called living document, and therefore they could read into it something that's not actually there, but some maybe private interpretation that they have themselves. Well, this is the way I interpret it, as if they're the authority, or this is what the Holy Spirit is telling me personally from the text, even though it's not what the original writer, filled with the Spirit, moved by the Spirit, breathed by the Spirit, intended when he wrote it down. I mentioned how destructive this approach was to the Constitution and how equally destructive it is to the Bible. And so if your approach is living Bible, living Constitution in the way I described it, then you're taking a relativistic approach to the meaning of the text, and the text of either document ceases to protect you. Now, do I believe that these documents are now dead? No, I think they're alive, in the case of the Constitution, with their original intent. And I think the Scripture is alive with its God-breathed original intent. Now, I laid that all out in much more detail last week, and you can go back to the the first podcast of last week to get more detail on that. But I have since seen some other things coming down in the news that I think are helpful. And in terms of elucidating or articulating this, in particular regarding the Constitution, because my view as a Christian is that the Constitution is there to protect my liberties and create an environment and a government that is sound and balanced and keeps it keeps the powers at bay. It is to limit the powers government has over us so as not to abuse the power and interfere with our God-given liberties. So this is why I see that with the Constitution of the United States, at least, we have there are spiritual ramifications to understanding it, because the Bill of Rights starts with our first freedom, which is a freedom of religion and a freedom to assemble and a freedom to speak. All of these things are really important for the promulgation of the gospel, which, by the way, is how this country was founded in its most primitive sense. The first Europeans to come to this continent came to practice their religion without interference. They were Puritans on the Mayflower. Okay? And so the Western colonization of this continent began with the desire to pursue religious conscience without interference. And so that was a foundational concept or value that compelled the forming of the Union that came later, the United States of America, the colonies to the U.S. of A. And that's why those freedoms were guaranteed by the new Constitution at the beginning, and this is why they're called first freedoms. And when there are judges who get creative, and I mentioned, I think, last time I talked about this, that the only thing alive in the living Constitution approach is the imaginations of the current jurists. With that approach, it is very, very easy to amend, for all intents and purposes, de facto amend the Constitution, not by the process that the founders had in view and is in the Constitution, but by the creative judgments of five justices on SCOTUS. Okay? So that by itself, never mind the application I made to the Bible, ought to be a concern to every religious person, and by the way, every non-religious person, because the first freedom there was that the state not establish a religion, and therefore atheists, for goodness sake, skeptics or all kinds of humanists should have a self-interest to protect the way that jurists read the Constitution. Because if it turns out, if there's a whole bunch of conservative, politically conservative jurists that get in there and they want to be activists, boy, that's not going to be good for the non-religious types, because generally political conservatives are religious. If I were a liberal in my political thinking, I would not want a person with a liberal view, living view of the Constitution on the bench, because I would no longer be protected either. Now, since I spoke those words last week, I noticed that there was something that was struck down by the Washington State Supreme Court. The title here is the Washington State Supreme Court strikes down $30 car tabs. Now, to be honest with you, I don't know much about this detail of the state of Washington. I was there a couple of days ago, and maybe this is why it came to my attention. But I don't care about the particulars of this particular initiative, but rather the reasoning of the Washington State Supreme Court here. It says I-976, the $30 car tab measure approved by voters in 2019. Notice, approved by voters in 2019, has been struck down by the Washington State Supreme Court. Here's the reason. It was found to be unconstitutional for violating the single subject rule, and also there's an inaccurate ballot title. Now, those of you who live in states that have the initiative process, and this is something that state of California has, I suspect a lot of them have that, where it's a straight democracy. You know how misleading they could be. And in fact, the titles and the way you vote sometimes, and I noticed this last time around, are such that you, if they have an unpopular initiative, they title it and word it in such a way that you think you're voting against it and you're voting for it. And I guess this is part of the concern in this I-976 $30 car tab measure, that it was an inaccurate ballot title. I don't know the details there, but it appears that according to the state Supreme Court, that when you have an initiative like this, it can only be about one thing. It can't be about a bunch of things. And apparently this, according to the court, violated that rule. Now, I'm not weighing in on this issue per se, because I don't know the Washington State Constitution, and I don't know anything about the $30 car tabs. Apparently, this is it was meant to avoid taxes, too much taxes on car owners, and if it got struck down, then that means more taxes on car owners that goes to public transit, and this is good for people who use public transit. I mean, that's kind of the policy issue behind it. And but as I read the article, I realized that, you know, people are – what part of the objection is that the people have spoken. The people say they want this, and the court overturned it. And as I read this, I applaud the court, not because I'm for or again I-976, which was overturned, but because the court, it looks like, was concerned with only the issue the court needs to be concerned with. And that is the state constitution, which has a single subject rule with regards to initiatives. Now, one of the frustrating things about the federal government for me are these massive omnibus bills like the budget bill or the Affordable Care Act. These are bills that have all kinds of provisions in them and amendments that, that of course, we've heard about this, the pork. What's pork? That's a whole bunch of stuff that's stuck in there by legislators to benefit their own constituency that have nothing to do with the bill as originally constituted. And so the idea of putting all of these amendments in with all this pork is essentially a violation of the notion of the single subject rule. Now, there is no such rule on a federal level. But you can see why the Supreme Court of Washington State is concerned about that. Because if you want to pass a good law on the federal level and then all these amendments are put in with all this nonsense and all this pork, then in order to get rid of the pork, the nonsense, since there is no line item veto, that means you veto just the part where the pork is, you have to either accept it all or reject it all. And if the general purpose of the bill is a good thing, you've got to go ahead and move forward with it, and you got to live with the nonsense that some politicians stick in there. Okay, so this is the problem, of course, and I suspect this is what the Washington State Constitution was trying to avoid. If you're going to have a bill, let's have a bill about one thing, and then we vote on the one thing instead of adding all these complicated factors that makes it harder for us to figure out whether we like the thing or not. All right. So this to me is an example of the Washington State Supreme Court doing what it ought to have done, regardless of how good the policy might have been that was advanced by the voters themselves. If the voters have a wonderful policy that is advanced and voted on, approved in a way that violates the Constitution, well, then it's unconstitutional. It's not unconstitutional because it's a bad idea. It might be a great policy. It's unconstitutional because, as written, it's a bad law that violates the Constitution. And that's when the Supreme Court should say, no, go back to the drawing board and find a way to accomplish your good goal in a way that's consistent with the Constitution. And that's the way it ought to be done. And that's kind of the originalist approach to adjudicating the Constitution of the United States. Now, I happened to read one other thing that really, it's a tweet that stunned me when I read it. And it stunned me because of the author of the tweet, who is, I mean, otherwise a very intelligent man. His name is Dan Rather. Many of you recognize the name. For decades and decades, he was a significant player in the American newsroom. I don't know who he worked for, and maybe he's still in play. I don't know. But he tweeted against the originalist idea of the law. Now, people are certainly entitled to their opinions, and a lot of people disagree with the way I have argued for the safe and proper use and adjudication of the Constitution of the United States. But when I read this comment and the reason why, I was slack-jawed, okay? And here's what Dan Rather tweeted. If you want to be an originalist in law, maybe you should go all the way, cooking on a hearth, leeches for medicine, an old mule for transportation, or maybe you can recognize that the world changes. Now, this is one of, I'm sorry, I don't like to use the S word very often, but sometimes it's the best word that applies. This is one of the stupidest things I have ever read in my life, especially coming from an otherwise intelligent person, Dan Rather. Clearly, this argument actually turns out to be an argument for dumping the Constitution altogether. I mean, after all, that was written 250 years ago or something like that. Times have changed. And if we're not going to use leeches for medicine and we're not going to use mule carts for transportation and we're not going to cook on a hearth, then why should we pay attention to anything that was written or any laws that were passed 250 years ago? Let's make it all up again. I mean, that would be what I'm using here is a taking the roof off tactic, if that's the way he wants to argue. All right. And it turns out James White, many of you know him, made an observation. And I actually, in the piece that I have here, I don't have the whole thing, but I've got the front end of it, and because it didn't come out in this printout that I have. But his reply was, it's stunning to realize that elites like Dan Rather are so disconnected from history, they can confuse the category of the original intention of the framers, and that's all I got. But I think he's going to say with like farming and transportation and medicine, which would be his point. They're two totally different categories, for goodness sake. Well, you know, it was 2,400 years ago that Aristotle clarified the law of non-contradiction. So, man, we should get with the times and reject the law of non-contradiction. No, some things are just kind of built in. Some things are good just the way they are. And even though we advance in other ways, it doesn't mean that the laws no longer should apply the way they applied then, particularly the Constitution. And incidentally, this is another taking the roof off, that is, okay, let's take this view seriously and let's see where it leads. Does Dan Rather have the same point of view towards Roe versus Wade? What was that, 48 years ago, 47 years ago? because that was almost half a century ago. And that was a decision that was written, like I said, half a century ago when we used 8-tracks. You know what an 8-track is, right? No, you don't. There you go. Before cassettes, there were 8-tracks. So if we are going to continue to enforce Roe versus Wade from the Supreme Court, their decision about the Constitution, and their intent, then why don't we just go all the way and drive cars that were made before 1973 and use rotary dial phones and listen to music on 8-tracks, if that kind of thinking follows. There is a procedure for changing with the times when the times and sensibilities and moral clarity of a people dictates a change in some foundational law. It's called Congress. Now, in this case, Congress is restricted by the Constitution, but there's a way to change the Constitution. It's the amendment process. It's not the creativity of, as I mentioned before, 5 jurists on the bench. The problem is, of course, that people like Rather apparently can't get their way through the legitimate process, so they want to do an end around with 5 unelected officials to subvert the will of the people. That is the problem with activist judges. That is the problem with an activist living Constitution view of the Constitution, and the only protection is to follow the law the way it was written or amend it according to the proper guidelines of the Constitution itself. Anyway, more to think about. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. To your calls in just a moment.
How do we prepare for the next cultural revolution that will sweep our society? And how can we prevent Christians from buying into this revolution's false ideas? Find out in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes, your favorite podcast app, or the top of the homepage at str.org.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible content each week? We rely on generous donors so that we can provide you with the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including our apps, blog posts, articles, and short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. Just visit str.org/donate to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources for more than 27 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Help us continue by making a financial gift today at str.org/donate.
I think it's my turn here. I haven't got my cue from the screen here because I don't see my mat here. But I think I'm supposed to I think I'm supposed to be talking now. I'm just pretending that I am. And I'll move forward. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today as I do every is that right? What happened there? I didn't get your cue, Matt. Now I see your picture there, but we're hiding him. We're all right. Okay, there it is. Am I just starting now? All right. Got you here. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, and I'm with you every Tuesday from 4 until 6, and that's Los Angeles time. So if you'd like to call, like so many of our callers have that are in the queue right now, you can do so by dialing up It's my number here, 855-243-9975 from 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. And I'd be glad to chat with you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Let's start with Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Chris. Hello, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hey, sir. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
So glad to do so, Chris.
Yes, sir. Yeah, so first I just want to thank you for your ministry. You, along with all the others, Frank Turek, William Lane Craig, late Ravi Zacharias, just had a significant impact on my faith. So I just want to thank you all for that.
Well, I'm glad to be part of that august group. Thank you.
Yes, sir. So my question has to do with discernment as a Christian. And I guess I should preface Christian with classical Christian. I've been a Christian my whole life, raised up in the church, was raised legalistic and Seventh-day Adventism, kind of got out of that in the late 90s and have really considered myself just to be a classical Christian, non-denominational since then. So so a couple of weeks ago, I had the privilege of seeing Frank Turek here, and I've watched a lot of his stuff online, so I'm very familiar with his presentation, but he makes a statement where he says if we shouldn't be calling ourselves Christians if we disagree with Jesus, and I couldn't agree more. And my question really has to do with today's progressive Christian movement. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of the ideas that progressive Christians are throwing out there. I've listened to your podcast last week with Elisa Childers and his, and it's not really doctrine, but it's just viewpoints, different views on Christianity. And so when I look at certain issues, hot topic issues, the one that comes to mind is like the issue of same-sex marriage and homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
You see people in the culture today like Jen Hatmaker or Matthew Vines that are, quote, Christians, but yet really champion homosexuality is something that they've spent a lot of time studying, and they've, you know, yeah, spent a lot of time in prayer, and they've, quote, used a lot of, I guess, Greek scholars to properly, as they would call, properly interpret the scriptures. And so my question really is in discernment. And when you start to see these people with these movements that are really, you know, kind of redefining certain issues that, at least for me as a classical Christian, I've always believed, you know, the traditional, hey, homosexuality, same-sex marriage is not approved. You know, it's not really something Jesus taught. Mm-hmm. My question is how do we discern between two opposing viewpoints in relation to the same issue when both viewpoints claim to be a result of thoughtful study, prayer, correct interpretation, you know, ultimately inspired by God? Because I see a lot of friends I know growing up that are, you know, grew up Christian, have changed their stance on a lot of these issues. And mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of it has to do with the cultural shift as of late, but
that might be.
I'm just trying to think, okay, you know, yeah, exactly. So I guess, though, you know, for me, who's someone who still considers a classical Christian that believes a lot of the kind of the sound biblical doctrine, a lot of those issues, I'm just trying to think of how do we discern between these people that are kind of rising up to have social, that have influence on social media, that have written books, and that are kind of swaying a lot of Christians that are starting to kind of, you know, quote, you know, be woke, if you will.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So in a certain sense, this is a lot more easy to answer than one might think, at least in principle. Maybe the details, making a decision between two options might be harder, but in principle, it's not difficult. Okay. So here's the first thing I'll tell you is to ignore certain things. When somebody says, this is the result for me of a lot of prayer, ignore it. Now, I'm not saying that they're not praying, but the fact that they prayed really hard about it and then give you their opinion is no good reason for you to believe their opinion, all right? It may be a good reason for them to believe their opinion, but it's not a good reason for you to believe their opinion. If they said, I put a lot of thought in this and a lot of study in this, you can largely ignore that one too. Because there are lots of people who put thought and study in it, and the amount of time they put into it or the amount of thought they put into it or the amount of study they put into it, that by itself doesn't make it a good idea, okay? Here's what you want. Here's what you want to know. And this is an example of what I call the Rhodes Scholar tactic. Now, the Rhodes Scholar tactic is meant to give us a tool to address the claims of educated people who have prayed a lot about it and who have thought a lot about it and who have studied a lot about
it.
And I'm not disparaging any of those kinds of things, but those are not relevant to you answering your question. The only thing that is relevant is the reasons the person holds the view that they have come to hold as a result of their prayer and their thoughtful study. What are the reasons? Now, prayer is not a reason. Thoughtful study is not a reason. These are both activities that help them, but what they have to do is give you the reasons. And this is why something like peer review is so important. All right? And so it was interesting that I was part of kind of a silent partner in a debate between Matthew Vines and Sean McDowell, all right, here in Southern California. And Sean laid out a case. Now, if anybody has heard Matthew Vines, and he's pro-homosexual, and I'm just going to say he claims to be Christian, okay? It's all I'm saying about that. He's one of those gay Christians, and he loves Jesus and believes all the things, but he also believes homosexuality is right, and he is encouraging others to embrace the idea and embrace their homosexuality and the church to embrace homosexuality, okay? So that, and so the debate is these two people who have both done lots of study and both done lots of prayer and have both thought about their ideas. Here's what matters, what they say in support of their ideas. And I'll tell you what happened in this particular discussion. What Sean did is he went to particular passages in Scripture. Like, for example, I'm not sure if he used this one, but I think he probably did to start out. And that's Matthew 19. And what's interesting about Matthew 19 is Matthew 19 is not one of the so-called clobber verses. Okay? Have you heard this phrase, Chris, clobber verse?
I have a little bit vaguely, but yeah, I know kind of what you're referencing.
Okay, so there are like six or seven passages that seem to speak directly about homosexuality and disparagingly about homosexuality. And that would be like Romans 1 and 1 Corinthians 6 and the two Leviticus passages, Leviticus 17 and 19, I think. And these are the clobber passages. These are the things that Christians bring out to clobber homosexuals. It's interesting the way they characterize these verses, because these verses, if they are in the Bible and appropriately being used, then even if there's one of them and they mean what they appear to mean, then they are God's clobber passage, clobbering a sin that needs to be corrected.
Yeah.
Notice, by the way, the rhetorical maneuver. And when people call these clobber passages, there's only like six of them. Oh, okay. Six clobber passages against homosexuality. Where are your passages in favor of homosexuality? Well, there isn't a single one in the Bible, because every single time that homosexuality is mentioned in the Bible, the verse disparages it for some particular reason. Now, I know that the Matthew Vines approach is to try to find ways of explaining those things away. Okay, well, you have to decide whether those explanations that he gives in light of the verse you're looking at is a good one or not. What Sean did is he went to Matthew 19. Now, excuse me, Matthew 19 doesn't talk about homosexuality. It talks about marriage. And what Jesus says is, from the beginning, this is the way it's been. One man, one woman, becoming one flesh, that's sex, for one lifetime. There it is. Now, Jesus covers a lot of ground in that one passage, but he makes it, among other things, excessively clear what God designed marriage to be like. And a couple chapters before that, or actually one chapter before that, he says he made the male and female, then be fruitful and multiply. And you can't be fruitful and multiply in a same-sex situation.
Yeah.
You have to have two sexes. So what did Matthew Vines do with that very, very powerful, contextually sound statement of Jesus regarding the original intention of the Father for sexuality and for gender and for marriage? He tried to walk away from it. He tried to just wave it off and dismiss it, and he began to change the subject. And Sean wouldn't let him.
Interesting.
And Sean said, wait a minute, I'm not going to let you do that. If Sean, if you know, you've seen Sean, I don't know, but he is very, very generous, gracious, thoughtful, and it was a really pleasant kind of environment there. But he was going to hold Matthew Vines' feet to the fire, so to speak. And so for the sake of your larger question, what was going on here is one side was offering the reasons for their view and the other side was avoiding it, all right, and was not able, in my view, to give any good reasons for, now watch this, the new view. The new view. By the way, that ought to tell you something. These Matthew Vines claims to find a theology in the scriptures that for thousands of years the church has never seen. Christians have been wrong for thousands of years, and now the progressive Christians get it right? I mean, that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
So what all I'm doing is articulating reasons why one view is sound and the opposing view is not. Notice I didn't say, but listen, Chris, I really prayed about this. And by the way, I've really thought
right.
about it. No,
right.
But I might say that sometimes. I've thought a lot about this, and here's what I think. And then I give the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just going to finish by saying what you're obliged to do, and any Christian is obliged to do, is look at the reasons, and that's the Rhodes Scholar tactic. What are the reasons the person holds the view? Not what is the view they hold that simply informs us of their view, but it educates us when we know the reasons they hold their view. And then we're in a position to assess whether we think the reasons are good ones or not. Okay? That's the simple answer.
Cool, thank you. So could I quick provide you two reasons that I've heard in the past and just kind of see what your thoughts are? I don't want to take up a whole lot more time, but there's two reasons I've typically heard people use that might have I haven't researched enough to kind of know myself. I guess one would be, and I think this is a Matthew Vines approach. I don't know a whole lot about a lot of his arguments, but the term homosexuality actually meant, you know, well, homosexuality outside of a marriage relationship or whatever, gang rape or something, you know, back then. But actually, you know, that's
I know what they say, certainly. And incidentally, Alan Schliemann and I wrote a piece about this. And I, you know, our title is not that good because I can't remember it. I keep getting it confused. So it's too complicated. I think it's called A Reformation We Don't Need. Amy will let me know in just a moment, so I'll fix it for you. But we wrote two pieces about the Matthew Vines approach, and Alan and Sean McDowell went to their conference, all right? And then they went, they looked at everything they taught and even met with the principals, told them who they were. This wasn't a subversive affair, and participated in the group discussions and were completely honest about their views. And then we took their material and their views as they describe it, and then we critique it. So in two issues of solid ground in which I deal with this so-called Reformation project, we answer all the objections. But the simple and more straightforward, most straightforward way of responding to the one that was raised there is, where in the text do we get this idea? You know, it's interesting because when you read the Romans text, for example, it says that that what they did is the males abandoned the natural function of the woman. It isn't just talking about the rapist there or someone who's taken advantage of a younger person. You don't get that sense anywhere in the passage. When you go back to the passages and read the passages, you do not get the sense that this is what's going on. The same thing back in Leviticus. When a man lies with a man, the way they are supposed to lie with a woman is the implication there, then they are both what? Executed. Now, if there was a guilty party taking advantage of an innocent party, why would they execute the innocent party? Because they aren't innocent, they were participating. And so when you go back to the particulars of the injunctions themselves, all of the qualifications that are read into the passages by the Matthew Vines crowd are not in the passages, and they are not clearly in the culture either, and that's the kind of argument they make. Didn't the early church understand the culture? Didn't the Christians at the time understand the culture that they were in? Where is all the positive, right? Where's all the Reformation?
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Here it is. A Reformation the church doesn't need is the title of that article, and you can find it at str.org. And line for line, argument for argument, we address each one of those things. All right. So
awesome. Yeah, thank you. I'll definitely go check that out.
I thought you said something about two questions to answer. Was that two or was that just one?
Yes, sir. Yeah. The second one is what the last one I've kind of, I don't know, there's a couple others, but the one I wanted to bring up was the relationship between Jonathan and David in the Bible. And I've heard some people use this as an argument, like a positive example where, you know, the Bible says that Jonathan loved David as he loved his own soul. And that's kind of been, I think, maybe a more positive, I guess, if you would say, example that I've heard from people in the past. And
sure.
And I know
yes.
there's different meanings of the word. You know, love has different meanings. There's different, Greek words for love. But I guess,
let me offer my own
on that.
I'll quickly offer my own take on that. Only a corrupt soul would read that into that relationship. There is not the slightest intimation in that any of those passages that their relationship was sexual. None. Oh, there is a comment. Mm-hmm. David loved Jonathan, or Jonathan loved David more than they loved a woman. But that is not unusual. It doesn't mean that it was sexual. It means the intensity of their love for each other, and that is not unusual in ancient cultures, and even in cultures today, when there's a wide division between men and women, and men have their deepest relationships with other men. It's not sexual, but it's still a deep relationship. And to read sexual things into a passage that gives no implication of that is just a corrupted way of thinking, all right? And incidentally, Matthew Vines and their crowd does not use that passage anymore because they know it's such a weak argument, as far as I understand it. The more recent ways of arguing abandon that stuff because it's so weak. But it all comes down to what's in the text, Chris. Does the text suggest this or imply it, or is this something you're reading into it? And that's what I think is happening in those cases, okay?
Awesome. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Thank you. Those are very helpful answers.
All right. I appreciate your call there, Chris. By the way, that article again is called A Reformation the Church Doesn't Need. Again, a little bit. Not this Reformation. Well, yeah, I don't know. I couldn't remember the right end. There it is. A Reformation the Church Doesn't Need. It's in two parts. And we go item for item. The case that is made by the Matthew Vines crowd and the whole progressive Christian crowd promoting homosexuality as a morally benign thing in itself and therefore promoting it in the church. Yes, it is progressive, but it's not Christian. And incidentally, I'll just add this. We're not going to go to break here because I want to get to the next caller, Anthony, in just a second. But there is a verse. I don't have my Bible handy. I forgot to bring it over here. And so at break, I'll have to get it. But because I'm tethered right now by the wire. But in Matthew chapter 7, it talks about wolves in sheep's clothing. You will know them by their deeds. And then Jesus says to something to the effect of, depart from me, you who work iniquity, or you who justify wickedness, or something like that. What Jesus is talking about is wolves in sheep's clothing, which means they're imposters that look like us. That's what it means to be in sheep's clothing. They look like us, but the effect of their influence on the church is to encourage wickedness. And Matthew Vines is a wolf in sheep's clothing. In many ways, he looks like Christians. He talks like Christians. But Paul says very clearly, sorry, clobber passage, 1 Corinthians 6:9, that homosexuals, along with, by the way, fornicators and adulterers, will not inherit the kingdom of God. And by the way, Paul says, be not deceived, right there in the verse. Watch this. Don't be misled. These are the kinds of people that will not inherit the kingdom because what they're doing is sinful. And if they are practicing this continually, this is their way of life, they're not in the kingdom. They're imposters. And if they look like us in every other way and they are encouraging wickedness, which this is, then they are examples of wolves in sheep's clothing, and Jesus himself warned us against them. All right. All right, let's go to Winnipeg, Manitoba, and Anthony, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thanks for taking my call, Greg. Sure. My question is, maybe Holy Spirit inspired here, because I saw the push notification that the show was starting on the app, and so I gave you a call, and then hearing your introduction to your program, as you were referring to some of what you covered last week about interpreting the Constitution and the biblical scriptures,
right,
the way the
right.
original author intended it, perfect segue for my question here. You may have already addressed it, the answer, but I'll ask it anyways here.
Okay.
How do you make a distinction? Is it simply an explanation of two different categories where the principle is different? Because I'd like to understand how to explain it, I guess the mechanics of it philosophically. I know the proper way, the proper hermeneutic to interpret scriptures and the Constitution is to interpret it in the way that the original author intended
right.
it.
Right.
How do we make a distinction between that category versus, say, a husband and wife in their relationship? The husband intends to communicate something a certain way. The
mm-hmm.
wife doesn't necessarily interpret it that way. And it would not be good, you know, relationally speaking, in that category, an interpersonal relationship, for the husband to say, well, honey, that's fine if you interpreted it that way, but I meant it this way. Therefore, you have to interpret
sure.
it the way that I meant it. It's probably better for the husband to try to maybe change the way he's communicating so that, you know, the wife receives it a different way and
gotcha.
It's a better outcome. So is it just simply explained away by the fact that it's a different category, or how would you explain the mechanics?
Well, it is. I actually have three quick thoughts on that. I got about four and a half minutes here before we go out and turn into a pumpkin. So let me quickly address this. And that is, first of all, it is a different category because when we're talking about either the Bible or the Constitution, we are talking about an authority that is over us. And when there's authority that is over us telling us how we ought to conduct ourselves, whether the proper behavior of government or functioning of government or the proper beliefs or behavior of Christians, the authority is the authority. So we cannot let our emotions read it differently. And if we do let that happen, then the authority ceases to be the authority and our emotions are the authority. Okay. When it comes to interpersonal relationships, it's different. And it could be that one person means something one way and the other person takes it another way. Okay. So I have, with regards to that, I have two responses. The first general response I just gave you, we're really talking about two different kinds of things. But in this second relational element, I think there is some legitimacy to say, no, you misunderstood me. And quite honestly, lots of times, especially when you have emotionally healthy individuals, they will acknowledge your correction. They will acknowledge the fact that that they had misunderstood something you said for whatever reason, not finding blame here. But then when there's clarification from the first person, then the other person can say, oh, okay, that isn't the way I understood it. I understood it this other way. So I think there is a place for that. And sometimes that is what rectifies problems. No, that was maybe I didn't explain myself clearly. Let me put it in a different way or whatever. Now, sometimes, especially when you're not dealing with people who are in healthy relationships, no matter what you say that could be, in a certain sense, innocuous, it could be heard for reasons pertaining to the mental health or the circumstances or the background or whatever of the one listening. It could be heard in a very different way than what you intended. And by the way, this is what counseling does a lot. Because counseling will uncover the things in our own lives that distort the way we hear things other people say. All right? And if you're in a situation like that where there's a consistent misreading, And it's not repairable by a clarification. Then, especially in a relationship of love and commitment, I think it becomes incumbent upon the person who's being misunderstood to adapt and adjust in some fashion to the person who continually misunderstands for reasons that may be beyond their healthy control. And I think, by the way, that's a very difficult situation to be in. I acknowledge it completely. But sometimes that's the way marriage works out. You know, we're in situations that I didn't mean it that way. Well, that's the way it sounded. Well, I that isn't what I intended. Well, that's the way it feels to me. Oh, man, I hate it when that happens, you know, because now what? Well, I think that what you have to do, Anthony, then, is you have to take that into consideration that no matter what you're doing unintentionally, it still is happening in the mind of the other person. And because you care about that other person, you want to you want to just try to compensate. You want to try to take that into consideration. So if you say something innocuous, if you're as a husband, say, for example, say something that all things being equal is completely innocuous and legitimate, pardon me, and you're not saying it in an inappropriate way, and consistently your wife reads it as a personal attack, and no amount of your explaining to the contrary is going to change her own reaction, then because you love your wife, you better change what you're doing. Find some other way to do it. Because you're the only one now that is in a position to change the dynamic between the two of you. And this is something that every single married person has to deal with sooner or later, the exact dynamic that you're describing. Look, we're out of time. Music's coming up here, but Joe, Anthony, I really appreciate your call, and I hope that what I've offered is helpful. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. The rest of you, and Anthony too, give them heaven. Bye-bye now.